This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, it's our weekly in-depth look at the stories and events affecting the tri-state area. And joining us this afternoon, our investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Managing Editor, Opinion and Engagement, David Holthouse. And later in the show, we'll talk about preparations for the Republican National Convention with reporter and producer Nick Castell from WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. We won't be able to take phone calls today, but you can still join us by emailing talk@wvxu.org or by finding us on Facebook or Twitter. And David and James, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to.
Let's start by talking about Cincinnati's proposed budget. The proposal for fiscal year 2017 has just been released. So, James, what's in it?
Well, overall, it's up. Spending totals is up about 3%, and that's based on anticipated tax revenues done, based on a survey or based on a study done by the University of Cincinnati. We haven't seen that actual study yet, but that's what the figure's based on. It's about totals of $378 million, I think, again, up 3%. What's in it is the money that the Parks Department had asked for, a total of $4 million. More money for I think the Citizens Complaint Authority, which has been an issue. But what's not in it, there's also more money for Queensgate, development of Queensgate, and more bike lanes. But what's not in it is human services are being cut. And that's actually a trend that is against what City Council had wanted to do. At one point, City Council had stated they wanted the budget to be about 1.5% to go towards human services. Instead, it's going backwards. It's going to be about 1% based on this, and they're losing about $350,000 out of the budget for human services like the health department and such like that. Also, transportation is taking a cut. The bridge repair fund is going down slightly, whereas things for public safety and things like that are staying about the same.
Okay. Of course, this is not set in stone yet.
No.
This has still got a long way to go before it's finalized.
It actually has to go to the mayor now, who has to mark it up himself, and then it goes on to City Council for full debate.
David, if I understand correctly, when they first started working on this, they had a pretty hefty deficit they were looking at. I believe it was around $14 million.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the good news is that the earnings tax forecast went up, supposedly growing by over 3% this year, which is good news. I mean, that's an indicator of a healthy economy or a healthier economy. So that's a positive, and that'll go a long way to cutting back on the deficit.
And the other part of that is that because of that, the original anticipated deficit was going to be $14 million, and now it's down to $6.5 million. I remember a couple of years ago, I wrote a story about how the other thing this budget doesn't do, it's not balanced exactly, but it isn't relying on a huge influx of one-time funding, which had been the way that the city had been balancing its budget. In accountants' terms, they were called bluebirds, which are one-time events where you could take in money, everything from a settlement with Anthem over healthcare to the anticipated money from the old parking deal that was a big controversy. Things like that were being used on one-time basis to balance a budget. They're not using those anymore. It's not quite balanced, but it's getting close to what they call a structurally balanced. And if I could shift for a minute, this money for the parks is probably going to become an issue as well because—
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect.
Right, because, you know, they were asked for this $4 million, and this is the same amount that they had asked for in the levy campaign or something similar along those lines, and all of the it's supposed to be used for upkeep and the management, but $1.5 million is going to go towards a new marina down on the Smale Riverfront Park, which, you know, some people in the community have questioned, do we really need it? And this is on top of the ongoing audit investigations into how the Parks Department has handled its finances and its relationships with its nonprofit organizations, as well as the use of these no bid bid contracts. We're expecting the results of an internal audit, which was sparked by some of the stories we wrote about it, and that's going to come out in early June.
I explain a little bit more about the no bid contract story that you've been doing.
Right. Well, what we were able to uncover in the city was actually investigating to shut this down too, was that $40 million of public money went to what are called these service agreement contracts, MSA, master service agreements contracts, which meant that a large portion of the park was built without bidding out individual things. So they have a master service agreement for keeping up with concrete construction. Well, they were using that contract for new construction, which people even within the city said you shouldn't do. So that created all these issues of fairness. Did they bypass the city's bidding process and so forth? And then the other side of it was another $43 million in private money went without using the city's bidding process into building SMAIL, and especially the pavilion and where the carousel is. A lot of that private money went in, and that's left the city with, okay, if there's those contracts weren't bounded or insured enough for the amount of work they were doing. So that leaves, if there's issues with later construction or liability, the city is kind of left, who do we go to get compensated for this?
Well, and if I understand correctly too, James, the Parks Department's argument would be, we use those master agreements. That's what they were there for.
Yeah, exactly. And that there was nothing improper, and that they did it. They wouldn't do it again, but they did it out of efficacy or try to speed up the process because they wanted everything done for the All-Star game last year. Or I guess it was now 2 years ago. It was last summer. But, you know, we found that they had been doing this since 2010, even before the city had won the bid for the All-Star game. So there's still a lot of outstanding questions about a lot of that. But like I said, it has led to, I think the public obviously had problems with the initial tax levy back in the fall with the way it was worded. And then subsequent stuff has come out about how they've spent the money, how they've used both the private endowment and the nonprofit and the relationships, that's going to be the focus of what's going to come out in this audit next month.
And you think that particular, the parks money in the budget, do you think that's going to be a particular point of debate as they work on finalizing this?
It's hard to tell because nobody wants to vote against the parks for some reason. It seems to be one of those untouchable kind of third rail things when it comes to funding. So who knows what's going to actually come out of that? I do know there are a couple members on council who are skeptical, but I don't know if they're enough to raise a total block to it.
David, what else do you see as being maybe some of the budget battles that are going to pop up as they work on getting this finalized?
Well, I think the parks will be one. I mean, I was glad to see actually that in this proposal anyway that $4 million was included for park maintenance. That is what they had proposed under the levy, which failed. And, I think our parks are in need of better maintenance. A lot of them, that's been, neglected for a long time. I think you might see some issues over the certainly over the human services cuts, maybe over the Port Authority's funding. I think they're supposed to get $2 million to clean up the old Hootapole property in Queensgate and prepare that for economic development. I like that proposal too. I mean, the Port Authority, that's really what they were created to do, was to clean up old sites in the city, and they need money to do that. So I think that's a positive, but you might see some issues around that. And then, there's the issue of employees' raises, so we'll see how that goes. I think you're talking about 3% raises roughly for a lot of the employees, which is fairly healthy compared to the private sector, so that might come up too.
Yeah, an addendum to what he was saying about the salaries is that, for a while there were many wage cuts for several years. So this might be a way to kind of make up that. But right. Again, is 3%, is do you do it all at once or do you kind of scatter it out? Is 3% when a lot of people in the private sector haven't had raises in a couple of years because we're still recovering from the recession?
And just one other area there is bridge repair budget. Is going down, and I think anybody who drives around the city knows that infrastructure is a big issue around here, and bridges are crumbling, so that might come up. It's a little surprised to see a cut there proposed, but hopefully that will be a debate.
Yeah, I mean, the city's overall grades for most of its bridges have gone down in terms of what the ratings and the inspections have shown as well. I mean, they're not, as a whole, they're not like dangerous, but they've gone from relatively good to satisfactory. So they are declining. And Cincinnati does have some of the older road infrastructure. So we have bridges, some of the bridges that are 100 years old around here. So
again, we have to emphasize that this is not the final product.
No.
These are just the proposals. And again, what's next for it, James?
It goes to Mayor John Cranley's office, who gets to review it, and then he presents it to full council for full approval.
And how long is that likely to take? When do
they have to? Well, I mean, they got a deadline of June 30th. So, you know, here we are towards the end of May. So I would imagine that we're going to have emergency sessions right up until the end of June.
Yeah, typically they push the deadline on that. So,
yeah, and sometimes they have extensions and the like. I mean, you saw what happened in the Kentucky with the Kentucky legislature earlier this year, with it went right down to the last day. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, have they still actually got that finalized?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that's done.
Yeah.
All right. David, we can start to talk about this a little bit before we take the break, but you're talking about the bridge funding, and there is just the never-ending debate over the Brent Spence Bridge, and we've got a new angle to that this week with the bridge being called the nation's top infrastructure emergency. Now, who declared that? Where did that come from?
Well, that was from a congressional report, and it was reported first by The Hill, a Capitol Hill publication. You know, we've been talking about the Brent Spence for years and years here, and there's been efforts to build a new bridge, but it's been tied up with how are we going to pay for that. The new administration in Kentucky, I believe, has succeeded in banning tolls to pay for the bridge. So which raises the question of now what? It's a big problem. I mean, this is Interstate 75, one of the busiest highways in the country, and it's tied up every day. There's accidents often on there. So we all know here how bad it is, but we can't seem to find a way to pay for it.
Yeah.
The striking thing about this is that it's become symbolic. The fact that this came out of Washington and not out of something locally, mm-hmm. it was the fact that Washington media talked to experts and so forth and found that this was, you know, they put it at the top of their list, that it's becoming a nationally well-known issue. Now, obviously, part of that might be because the president used it as his backdrop when he was pressuring Congress, both McConnell and Boehner, right in his own backyard, in their backyard, to fund a budget bill back in 2011. I remember I wrote a huge package, a project back in 2003 that outlined the dangers of the bridge. It's not at that time, it wasn't in danger of falling down. But since then, it's only gotten worse.
I believe what they did, James, was that the terminology they use is that it's functionally obsolete.
And it still is.
Yes.
And it still is, which means it doesn't...
Not structurally yet, but
right.
It's getting there.
But the grades on the reports, and I pulled these a couple years ago, the grades on the reports are significantly decreasing. They haven't painted it in more than 20 years, so it's starting to rust. And what their strategy was, we'll wait to repair it when we get all the money for the Brent Spence. Well, that money's never coming. So even if they don't replace the bridge, they've got to do something about the state of the existing bridge. I mean, there's pieces of concrete falling off of the supports on some of the ramps that fell on a car a couple of years ago. So this is the concrete starting to crack.
The bridge opened, what, early 1960s?
So yeah, it was right after Kennedy was assassinated. And they had actually talked about renaming it for him, but then they decided not to. We talk about it's an emergency. It carries 4 or 5% of the nation's GDP. It's billions of dollars in freight. It's right on the what they call Auto Alley, which goes all the way from Detroit down to Florida, all those manufacturing plants all the way down there. So yes, it's we are tied up in the local parochial politics of it and how to pay for it, but it is a national issue. It is a national choke point.
One would think that some more federal funding could be found for this vital piece of interstate and that it's not just a state issue.
Well, that's been what's so frustrating to even within the debate. locally is that the people who are anti-toll say, you know, well, why don't the federal government pay for it? And to be honest, I think they have a point. You've got at the time we had the House Speaker in our backyard, and we had the Senate Majority Leader from the state that owns the bridge, but yet we can't get any money out of them. And it seems to be that there's a growing sense of frustration over this, and that it is. Granted, the federal funding system for highways is broken as it is. It's based on the gas tax, and the gas tax has been decreasing because people's mileage is increasing, so people aren't buying as much gas as they used to.
Well, and James, there's another question, too. Has this one ever been resolved? Repair or replace? It's not just a funding issue, but have they ever decided one way or the other, are we going to actually replace the bridge?
The current plan calls for to repair the existing bridge and build one next to it, so use both bridges.
So you've got a hybrid plan, a combination
of
both things.
Yeah, that's the existing plan. The $2.5 billion plan that exists right now is to route 71 on the old bridge and all the local traffic on the old bridge, and the new bridge would carry 75 around, basically, through Queensgate. I think to your point, it's a bit of a hybrid.
And I think it's, we're coming up with a major redevelopment of Interstate 75 on the Ohio side, which is going to widen that and but it's going to funnel into this old bridge again. Basically, it will be a highway to nowhere.
Right.
It's really going to make matters worse on the bridge.
And the question remains, how long will we be debating the bridge and discussing the bridge? A long, long time.
Right.
Well, we'll continue our conversation about the news of the week, and you can join us by emailing talk@wvxu.org or by finding us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us this afternoon as we review the news of the week, investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Managing Editor, Opinion and Engagement, David Holthouse. And we won't be taking calls today, but you can still join us by emailing talk@wvxu.org or by finding us on Facebook or Twitter. James, you wrote a story about the use of force by local police departments.
Yes.
What prompted you to go looking into that?
Well, there's a couple of things that started us on this path. One is obviously it's part of a national conversation that we've had to deal with here locally, especially with the tragic shooting of Sam DeBose by the University of Cincinnati, then University of Cincinnati police officer. So we wanted to broaden our look just from the UC Police Department to look at other departments. And then the second one is obviously this is the 15-year anniversary of the unrest in 2001 that was sparked by police shootings in Cincinnati. So we did some stories back then, but we really haven't swung back around to take a look at what the state of the use of force is by police now. But we didn't want to just focus in on just one agency. We want, you know, and pick on, feel like they were being picked on. So we thought we'd take a broader look. So I'm looking and collecting data from 25 different agencies throughout 7 counties in both states, just determining how often they use it, what kind of force do they use.
Right. When you're talking about, use of force, there are several different aspects of this, right?
Absolutely. The first story that I wrote stated that, amazingly, there are no standards and there's no requirement to even keep data on this. Some departments do keep data to make sure they can track it in case they get sued, and it's almost a requirement by their either accreditation agency or their insurance company. But apart from that, there's no national standard. There's no place to report it to. There are certainly, the FBI asks that you report any time that a police officer is injured or killed so they can track that. But even crime stats that the local agencies report to the FBI are all voluntary as well. So like I said, this has been a very interesting exercise in terms of trying to create some kind of standard even locally for what we're looking at, how we're looking at it. Some agencies keep certain data, some don't. It's really been interesting to see even as simple statistics such as how many arrests did you total make in a year? Some agencies couldn't even give me that.
David, are you surprised with all the focus nationally, locally on these use of force incidents? Does it surprise you that there is this lack of data out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that there ought to be some standards about how do we keep track of this and, you know, exactly how often this happens and what are the circumstances surrounding it. It would go a long way, I think, towards, you know, finding out exactly what happens in these incidents. So, you know, the other piece is, you know, the growing use of body cams is going to help, I think, in figuring this out, and also whether the videos from those body cams will be made public quickly or not. That's in Ohio is at the Supreme Court right now. So that's a huge issue, I think, in kind of how do we move forward as a society in dealing with these and kind of getting at really what actually happens during these incidents.
Yeah, and the Inquirer is actually involved in that case in the Supreme Court. And it's funny because Joe Dieters, the local prosecutor, wants it to be ruled on. He's not necessarily – he disagrees with our stance, but he's glad it's gone this far, so we have a set policy. We view that as much as it is as arrest report or a 911 call. He views it as evidence in an investigation. So we have to figure out the courts have to figure that out. And one thing on the stats and the transparency and the such, I do want to mention that Cincinnati does deserve the CPD, Cincinnati Police Department specifically, does deserve a little bit of a shout out on this because they've joined a consortium of about 100 different agencies nationwide that are sending their data to a portal that's been created by the White House, who is created a task force to look at use of force, to look at just basically policing issues nationally based on what's happened in Ferguson and Baltimore and all these other cities where this has become, or Chicago, where it's become major, major issues. So there is a movement, but that's 100 out of 80,000 law enforcement agencies nationwide.
Yeah,
so,
because this is not just a local problem, is
it? No, it's not. So you know, that transparency. Everybody agrees transparency is good, but then it, you know, where do you draw the line at, you know, do you trust us or don't you trust us? And it becomes a trust issue between the community and the police.
David was touching on the idea of body cameras. Mm-hmm. Does this point out to you that there's a need?
Well, I've had several people tell me that, imagine what could have happened in the Tenzing DeBose case as I'm doing my reporting if there hadn't been a body camera. You could see at the end of that video that they're trying to – he's saying, you saw that, right? Oh, yeah, I saw that. So they're getting their stories together, not to indict him or anything. It's just that the police, in a situation like that where it's a lone suspect and he's shot and killed, the police own the narrative. So this certainly does change that ballgame. I wanted to add on what we're talking about the Supreme Court. Just this week, local legislator Alicia Reese pulled her bill. She was trying to create legislation that would have standardized how body cameras are used. She was trying to create a law about this, and she had compromised several times with the Fraternal Order of Police. Well, finally they asked, well, we want to be able to review it before it's released to the public as evidence. And she's like, I'm done. So she pulled the bill because she felt like she had given so far. So this is an ongoing, like, you know, how much of access do the police want? How much? And it's not going away.
Well, go ahead, David.
I was going to say in the budget, we were talking budget before, but there is money for body cams for the Cincinnati police in this current budget proposal.
Yeah. And they're making that transition to everybody wears a body cam in Cincinnati. Now, the other agencies, it's catch-as-catch-can in the other seven counties.
Well, is there an easy solution to keeping track of the use of force data, though? Is there anything as you were doing your reporting, is there anything that became readily apparent that this is an avenue that they could take that would help?
Well, no, because it also comes down to funding. Hamilton County Sheriff's Office, for example, told me they're still using Microsoft money from the early 2000s to keep track of some of their finances. So they're saying, oh, we're going to get new computers next month or next year. So they don't have the technology. The technology hasn't caught up. Middletown Police, for example, gave me 700 pages of paper that I had to hand count because they didn't track them. They didn't put it into an Excel spreadsheet. So they're, you know, A, they haven't felt the need to do it. So they haven't paid for it and they don't have the technology to do it. I'm not saying they're doing anything wrong by doing that. That's not a condemnation. That's just the way it is. But if you want that, And if that becomes a priority, that's where it's going to have to go. You're going to have to sink some money into technology to get caught up.
Well, you can also make the point too, James, that this is not just about catching police and wrongdoing. This, if they have better record keeping and better standards, it's a way of protecting themselves.
You can say, okay, this is a hot spot where we're having to use force more than ever at this hour or in this block, or this officer has seemed to have a trend of it. Does he need more training? Even if it's justified, is there more training he can do? The data, White House had a conference call on this, and there were chiefs of police from all over the country on the press, the call, and they said, this data helps us be better policemen because we can identify. We're not out to make cops look bad. We're trying to make cops better.
David, let's talk about something in terms of the heroin epidemic in this community. And I found this to be a very astounding story that you had about heroin overdoses at the downtown branch of the Public Library of Cincinnati in Hamilton County, that they've actually been increasing.
Yeah, they have. I mean, it's still a relatively low number, but, you know, there's six so far this year compared to, I think, three all of last year. So, you know, the library has kind of long been a place for people who need a warm place to hang out, to kind of, you know, loiter. So it sounds like people are using it to shoot up and indeed overdosing. I think it's kind of a sign of how prevalent this problem is now and how widespread it is and how it's really affecting so many institutions and so many people. And how addictive this substance is, that people are finding the need to use the library to shoot up. I think it's just a sign of the pervasiveness of this epidemic right now.
Hmm. Yeah. What have library officials had to say about this?
You know, not a whole lot. I mean, it's not really an issue, but obviously they're going to have to take some steps to prevent this or to react to an overdose. And, you know, have Narcan on hand and so forth. I mean, it's just becoming a reality these days that this is the way, we're going to need to operate. It's happening all over.
So six so far this year.
That's right.
And if the trend continues, it could be how many over the course of the year?
Well, if the trend continues, it would be probably around 15 this year. So
and that matches trends that have been going on for the last 5 years in Northern Kentucky. Just you talk to St. E's and the number of hospital emergency room overdoses that they're having to do, it's still climbing even now, even after we've identified and tried to throw money at the problem. It's still on the rise, even in Northern Kentucky. So, you know, it's a major issue, but it's also become kind of a social flashpoint. I mean, just last week in Boone County, the county commissioners.
They're trying to get a needle exchange program.
Well, they didn't. They just basically, they proposed the law, but nobody would second it, and they just let it die in silence because there are those in the community who feel it enables addicts. The needle exchanges just basically enable addicts, and otherwise, whereas the advocates for such measures say, well, at least you're getting the dirty needles off the street, and you're not helping prolong or spread AIDS or HIV or hepatitis C, which are also on the rise in Northern Kentucky. And Kentucky was just identified recently as one of the highest risk states for HIV growth in the nation because of the heroin epidemic.
Yeah, the CDC did an analysis really trying to find where the next Scott County, Indiana, might happen. Scott County, rural county in south central Indiana, had a rapidly growing HIV outbreak. It's a county of only 20,000 people. They had 200 people came down with HIV in a matter of months, all solely due to sharing needles to inject drugs, painkillers. And so the CDC analyzed every county in the United States to see where the next HIV outbreak might occur. Kentucky had 54 counties identified as vulnerable to HIV or hepatitis outbreaks due to needle use. Eight of the top 10 at-risk counties are in Kentucky. They ranked all the counties, eight of the top 10. And so it's really kind of disheartening to see Boone County officials sort of neglect that information when it comes to a needle exchange, because that is the way right now to try to contain or prevent an HIV.
To mitigate the risks of
an
of
outbreak.
That. Yes.
That's right.
Does Northern Kentucky have a needle exchange program yet?
There's one already started, I think, in Grant or Pendleton County.
Grant County approved one. Pendleton does too, actually.
And Kenton County is still considering it.
But they're the first and only one so far.
In Northern Kentucky, yes.
Yeah, and Cincinnati, of course, has an exchange program.
Cincinnati has one, and then there's been one approved but not started in Louisville and Lexington. But obviously the political climates in those cities are much different than Northern Kentucky.
Kentucky has some hoops to jump through to get a needle exchange. The law is such that the fiscal courts have to approve it, then a city in the county has to approve it. And so it's quite a ways to go before they can actually do that. But I think Kenton County commissioners have approved that. And so they've started down the road.
Yeah, they just haven't found a city that's willing to take it yet.
Right. So.
David, you had an editorial on WCPO.com this week calling for Ohio Governor John Kasich to declare the heroin epidemic an emergency. So tell us about that. What if he declares a state of emergency over this, what effect would that have?
Well, it would unlock resources of the state immediately because the governor has a lot of power under an emergency order. So that would free up money, staffing, to attack this epidemic. You know, over 2,000 people died in Ohio in 2014 from heroin or painkillers. That sounds like an emergency to me. And the governor has used his emergency powers in the past for much less. You recall a few years back when some exotic animals escaped from a backyard preserve near Zanesville. He declared an emergency around that. I think the only person that died was the zookeeper there. But we've got 2,000 people dying a year. So that could unlock money for Narcan. That could free up money for every first responder in the state to have a steady supply of Narcan to save lives. It could unlock resources of the Ohio Department of Health to try to attack this issue from education standpoint. I believe in our editorial board, it believes it's truly a catastrophe in Ohio that needs an emergency action.
Yeah, when he was campaigning for the GOP presidential campaign, he talked about how serious the heroin epidemic is and the effect it's having on the country. So I wonder if you think that maybe he's listening. Maybe you get a sense that he's going to take some kind of action.
I hope he's listening, and he has talked about it quite a bit. And, you know, to his credit, for example, he expanded Medicaid, which is helping people get treatment and so on for drugs.
He took his own party on that. You know, the one thing that I've kind of been surprised at is that there hasn't been more movement for funding within the Ohio legislature. I mean, Kentucky passed what was considered a landmark bill nationally last year that started funding $20 million towards its epidemic last year. Plus, it included the ability to start needle exchanges, Good Samaritan provisions, the ability for first responders to use Narcan and not be sued for it. There was a lot of things in there that I thought might spread to states like Indiana and Ohio that are also dealing with this, but it seems like the legislature doesn't want to pick it up, so it comes to the governor to have to spend the money.
Exactly. Legislative action takes a long time, and that bill in Kentucky took at least 2 years to get done. The governor can act immediately under an emergency order and basically bypass the legislature.
But the interesting thing to me is that there has been – I mean, you could see it building. Yeah, it failed. They tried a couple of times, but it built and finally got passed last year, whereas there's been no efforts from what I've seen in the Ohio legislature, even though it is spreading like wildfire in Ohio just like it did in Kentucky.
Absolutely.
David and James, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Investigative reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, James Pilcher, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Managing Editor, Opinion and Engagement, David Holthouse. And we will continue our conversation. After this, we'll hear about Cleveland's preparations for the Republican National Convention. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The Republican National Convention comes to the Buckeye State this summer. It's being held July 18th through the 21st at Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland. And this will be the third time Cleveland has hosted the event and the first time since 1936. And joining us with a preview and to talk about preparations Cleveland is making, reporter and producer Nick Castell from WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. We aren't able to take any calls today for the show, but you can still join us by emailing talk@wvxu.org or by finding us on Facebook or Twitter. And Nick and Howard, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Sure.
Sure.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
Good. Good, thanks.
How crazy is it up there, Nick?
Well, if you step outside, it's pretty calm right now. I think the craziest thing in downtown Cleveland is that they're shooting a movie. But certainly there's a lot of preparations that the city is doing right now that are getting some attention. One of the big things that Cleveland is doing that's getting a lot of attention is buying gear for police to get ready for, manning the security posts during this convention.
How many people is this expected to draw to Cleveland, Nick?
Well, yesterday I spoke with someone from the Republican Committee on Arrangements, and they're, the folks who are organizing what's going to happen inside of Quicken Loans Arena. They're saying 15,000 media plus 5,000 delegates. That includes the official delegates as well as their alternates, plus some guests, the nominee, and then you can imagine all the other folks who are coming in to provide security. So it's going to be a lot of people.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge thing. They always, at these things, set up a perimeter around the venue, and I don't know if that's happened yet. Do you know?
Well, it's something that we're kind of waiting to hear about. They will be setting up a perimeter. The Secret Service has been very tight-lipped about what specifically they're going to be doing, and they say at some point before the convention they're going to tell us where the perimeter is, but it's not yet because that information hasn't been put out yet.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, I've been to a lot of these things.
You have indeed.
This will be my 15th from both parties, and usually by this time, all of that's set and ready to go, and everybody knows, what's going on. But this is different. I mean, this is going to be a lot more complicated, I believe.
Well, and with as many as you've been to, Howard, I mean, just how complicated can things get?
Well, they can get very complicated logistically and, just getting people around, getting that many people around. When you're using, practically all the hotel space in a major city, and getting people funneled into that perimeter and into that venue where the convention is held is a massive undertaking.
Nick, what about hotel space? I mean, how tough is it going to be to find a hotel room near Cleveland when this is going on?
It's going to be pretty tough, especially if you're starting to look right now. You may have to stay pretty far away. Even some delegates are staying pretty far. The California delegation was given a hotel rooms in Sandusky, about an hour away from Cleveland. And I think some of them talked to CNN and said they were pretty unhappy about how far away they're going to be. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be tough to find. Cuyahoga County, was preparing for this as well. And they negotiated an agreement with Airbnb to start collecting a lodging tax. The same tax that's applied to hotel rooms in the area is going to be applied to some of these, sharing economy places where you might stay too. So, not really options to avoid paying the usual taxes as well.
Yeah.
So what about local businesses, Nick? What kinds of things are they doing to gear up for this?
Well, some of them are applying to be, official businesses that will be vendors for the RNC. Just recently, they announced, the party announced the official caterers they'd hired to be feeding all of these delegates. And it's a mix of a lot of local and Ohio-based companies, as well as some bigger companies like Aramark. So there's those things as well. The head of the host committee said some time ago that if you're thinking the RNC is going to be a huge boon for your business, you might want to give some second thought to that, because it's just not going to be a giant windfall for everyone doing business in the area.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of expectations that I think are going to have to be mediated and moderated a little bit, because this is going to be happening in downtown Cleveland. People will be going to certain places, but it doesn't mean that everybody in the region is going to be making lots of money.
Yeah. That's been my experience with these things. A lot of the business people around the area, like restaurant owners, bar owners, and that kind of thing, they don't see the big bump in business because people are being shuttled into the venue and then shuttled out, to some remote location at a hotel or something. So there's really not that much you know, opportunity to wine and dine and, you know, and see the city.
And some of these businesses, you know, it's already sort of been decided, too. I mean, there are media organizations that have rented out space in restaurants for the week or for certain days. So it's not like they're, you know, one night deciding, well, where are we going to take, you know, all 50 of our employees out to dinner? They kind of already know where they're going.
Mm-hmm. Nick, have city officials ever given any kind of an expected economic impact from this event?
You know, if there is one, I'm not aware of it off the top of my head. I believe that there will be a study conducted. So afterward, you know, they'll give us a sense of what the impact is. Hard to say at the moment what exactly it's going to look like.
What about traffic? Have they been looking at what might happen with traffic and things you can do to mitigate any congestion?
Well, that's a big question that we're sort of waiting for an answer on, because exactly what streets are going to be closed downtown will depend on where the security perimeter is. And so, you know, we're sort of, you know, waiting to see exactly how that's going to turn out. I think anecdotally people expect that traffic is going to be tough. If they can stay home and work from home that week, they might prefer to do that. I've heard people just say to me that they want to stay far away from downtown during the RNC.
that's generally what happens, at these things. The locals, they just want no part of it. They want to stay home. They don't want to deal with it.
So they all disappear for the time?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you don't see them that much. You know, one of the things that, you know, obviously this city was trying to get this land this convention, and Cleveland obviously won. And realistically, Cincinnati didn't have a chance because we didn't have a venue. We have U.S. Bank Arena, which is not a NBA-type arena that can hold, you know, 25,000 people. And, you know, Cleveland just had natural advantages over Cincinnati in that competition. I mean, we had no chance whatsoever. I could have told you that from the start.
Nick, as far as you're talking about a lot of things that they're going to be costly, extra security and making all these different arrangements. How's the RNC at paying bills? How are both the parties at paying bills for these kind of things?
I mean, you know, a lot of the cost is being borne, you know, by local businesses making contributions, as well as, you know, national corporations. The RNC host committee is charged with raising something in the ballpark of like $65 million or so, somewhere in the 50s and 60s. Yeah. And so this is all contributions that they bring in to help pay for the event. There's also a $50 million federal grant that has been given to Cleveland to pay for security. So that's to pay to buy all this equipment, as well as to pay for the costs of bringing in police from out of town and out of state to provide security outside of the convention zone.
But there is so much. I mean, there just about every aspect of this has some sort of corporate sponsorship. You know, they line up to give money to, you know, to the RNC, and they get a lot of publicity out of it, and they get a lot of, you know, goodwill from it. But you know, it does cost a lot of money.
Howard, you said you've been to 15 conventions, thereabouts.
This would be 15. Yeah.
What was your favorite one of all time?
Oh my. well, I mean, there were some I enjoyed more than others. 1992 in New York, when Clinton was first nominated, that was a lot of fun. And 1988 in New Orleans, when the choice of Dan Quayle blew up, and it just became a firestorm over, you know, his a military record and that sort of thing. That was crazy, and just the fact it was in New Orleans was great. I mean, there have been a lot of great places. The last 4 years ago, not so great. Tampa was no good. Logistically, it was horrible. Charlotte was a little better for the Democrats just because it was easier for everybody to get around.
Nick, you know, it's interesting. There have been a lot of cities that have hosted conventions, so I wonder if I know Cleveland's got a lot of pride about the city. Is there this kind of competitive feeling up there that we're going to be the best, we're going to show everybody else up and show them how to do this?
Well, you know, Cleveland has been trying for a long time to land one of these conventions. They've been applying election year after election year after election year. And so when this was announced 2 years ago now, there was a lot of pride. I mean, and you know, to a certain degree, local officials who secured this this convention were kind of patting themselves on the back and saying, this is a sign, this is an example of how far we have come as a city and how well we've been able to work together. Mm-hmm. You know, so they saw that at least as an opportunity to sort of toot their own horns a little bit. So there is a certain element of local pride in all of this. But I think among residents, there's also a little bit of a wariness about what exactly is this going to mean for the city? What are protests going to look like? What's traffic going to look like? So I think, you know, it's a mix of feelings.
Nick, did I hear you correctly? You said 15,000 media members are going to descend on Cleveland?
Mm.
Easily. Yeah, that's according to the that's according to the RNC.
Yeah. So tell me, what kind of preparations at WCPN are you making for this?
Well, I'm debating whether or not I want to just bring in an inflatable bed into the office and stay here for the week.
Yeah, that might be a good idea, Nick. Yeah.
But, you know, broadly, you know, more broadly, we're planning out our coverage and, you know, also sort of getting all of our information together so that we can have space inside of the convention so that we'll be able to cover things from inside and from outside. And I know sort of above my head, there have been plenty of meetings, you know, planning out logistically how this is all going to work.
And Nick, I know whenever we have a big event in town or whenever outside media want to use a resource, they'll often approach us here at WVXU and say, can we use your studios for this or that or the other? Are you at WCPN, are you getting a lot of that?
I believe so. I don't know all the details, but I know a number of national programs have, I think, contacted us, interested in finding space. I think NPR is going to be here as well. So, yeah, I mean, there is some interest there. I'm not sure exactly who or what exactly has been, you know, agreed upon.
And NPR generally has a huge workspace in the media center, wherever that ends up being for this convention. Mm-hmm.
So, Nick, what advice would you have for people if they're thinking about coming up there for the convention or coming anywhere near Cleveland in July?
Don't.
Yeah. Well, if you're not a delegate, you're not already approved to get in, you're not going to be able to, like, show up at the queue and walk in to see the Donald Trump speech as if it were a Cavs game or something. If you're not approved, you can't get in. It'd be difficult to even get inside the security zone, and you might get into trouble if you tried. So, you know, the closest you might be able to get is a nearby bar where you can watch it on TV. So I guess my advice would be if you haven't planned already, it might be tough to even find a place to stay.
And I think Howard, you probably concur with that. Watch it on TV.
Absolutely, yes. If you don't, you know, if you're not part of it in terms of being credentialed media or a delegate or alternate or one of the vendors or whatever, this is not a very good up close spectator sport.
And of course, how are you going to be there, right?
Yeah,
wouldn't miss
it,
right?
Yeah, and you know, right now, I mean, Cleveland's probably a little more focused on the Cavaliers, anyway.
Yeah. Well, and you'll be reporting for us at WVXU right. And on Cincinnati Edition when you do go up
exactly.
And watch the convention. So, Nick, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Howard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reporter and producer Nick Castell from WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland. And WVXU's Howard Wilkinson.